sometimes we get too complacent and too comfortable because we've got this money coming in from ABC company or ABC client, and they've been great and they're just consistent, and we don't go any further in looking for more.
Welcome back to the Making Money Podcast, where we talk about how to make more money, keep more of what you make, and make your money work harder for you. I am your co-host, Benjamin Foss, and before we get started, I have to say this is not financial advice. Sitting across from me, as always, is the wonderful entrepreneur and business owner, Paul Ng. Paul, how are you today, my friend?
I am doing well, Ben. Thank you.
It has been a long and stressful week already, but we are happy to be here and happy to be continuing our series on how to unstuck your business. All of us as business owners and entrepreneurs inevitably reach some point in our business where we feel a plateau, we feel a decline, we feel like there's a ceiling or a wall that we want to break through in order to take our business to the next level. But sometimes we don't know how to do that. And in this series, we're encouraging entrepreneurs and business owners to take a step back, reflect, and ask yourself some key questions to help bring clarity about where your business is at and where you want it to go, and hopefully illuminate the way to get there. Continuing on our list of questions, I'm really excited for this one because this is something that not a lot of people think about, but actually can be very powerful and influential, which is how much power do my customers have? Or more specifically, does a customer have? Here with me today, I have this book called Built to Sell. This is a really awesome narrative style business book written by John Warlow. And in this book, John talks about a number of issues related to a fictional small business run by a guy who's kind of getting older and wants to spend more time with his family and is looking to exit the business. And in this story, he gets mentored by an individual who helps set up his business to sell. Now, this book is really relevant even if you're not looking to exit or sell your business, because a lot of the principles in it just have to do with a healthy and well-balanced business. And this issue of how much power do your customers have is one that they talk about. They talk about how having one customer that takes up too much of the slice of the pie of your revenue, if they have 20 or 30 or 40% of your revenue as one customer, it can be a very bad thing, because that customer has a lot of power over you as a business owner, as an entrepreneur. They have a lot of power to dictate what you do, what services you offer, don't offer, and the price that you offer them at. So Paul, talk to us a little bit about why is it important to have sort of that diverse customer base, and how might we get there?
Absolutely. Our client base is who we are going to get our most momentum from. So learning and understanding who your customers are is always number one. And as I always say, it's your target market. Understanding who your target market is huge. Knowing how to work with them so that they're not working you. I think that's where we always kind of get a little too relaxed about, I think, because we rely so much on our maybe one or two customers, and we forget that there's a whole plethora of customers that we could reach out to, meaning that to diversify your pool of clients or customers, as we'll call it, and not be dependent on just one customer, and to be able to market to more masses, not just one segment of the market. Sometimes we get too complacent and too comfortable because we've got this money coming in from ABC company or ABC client, and they've been great and they're just consistent, and we don't go any further in looking for more because that money is too good, or it's so easy, or I don't even have to think about it because they're on auto refill or something. Well, what happens when that customer decides to go to our competitor and now they're offering them this incredible deal that we now need to compete against? Could that be a problem? Potentially. But really, we need to not rely on one customer. And it's not to say that that's the only reason. That's just one of the reasons. Several other things could be involved with this, such as what is the market doing today with what you're offering, what product or service you're offering. If you were in such a niche before and now you have other competitors, that's our main problem. The second thing is now there is availability for your client and others of the same nature to go shopping. So you're not that special person that once was. Is that good or bad? I don't know. Sometimes it could be good because now you can say, oh, well, I've made all this money and now I can undercut them because I've made this money in the past and I've saved it, not spent it. Or the other side where I've made all this money and I kept spending it and didn't save it, so now I can't compete. So how do you handle that? Well, let's cut back and go back to the initial question. Where do we stand with that one customer and what do we do about our product and service? So A, hone in on who your target market is. B, expand your market to availability to others so that you can grow and grow with the community. And C, be able to be competitive in a way and manner that you are able to provide to that current customer and to other customers and be able to now compete in that market. So you know who your target market is, you know what you need to do moving forward, and you understand what your competition is. So don't let yourself be defeated because you've relied on one client.
I love the example they give in this book. It is a graphic design company, and they have a, what you might call a whale, right? A major client that is a massive percentage of their annual revenue as a business. And this client has them doing brochures and websites and mailers and flyers and all kinds of a wide range of graphic design tasks. But what their team and their founder is actually really good at is business logos. They have a great sense and feel for meeting with founders, talking with them about the company, what they do, and designing a great professional logo for them that helps with their unique branding. But they didn't have the ability or resources to market to those customers or focus on serving those customers because all of their time and resources were spent serving the one whale client. And not only did that put them at liability for going under if that client ever decided to move on, like Paul was talking about, but it also kept them from focusing on the ideal customer and the ideal business model for them. So moving away from relying too much on a small number of customers not only helps insulate you from risk, from having no leverage in negotiating with your customers, but it also helps enable you to focus on the business model and strategy that is actually best for your unique business rather than catering the business to one particular client.
Absolutely. And if there's additional, let's say, services or an additional add-on product you can provide to your customer, that's always helpful. The word upsell is what's coming to mind. And as you know, an upsell really is something you don't necessarily need, but the customer may be excited about this upsell. Not that they need it, like I said, but it's that momentum that you're trying to build with your clientele. It's also selling the additional products you might have available that aren't moving, or the additional service that nobody else is providing. Giving that extra touch is not always just an upsell. It is to be able to provide an addition to your clientele.
Moving on, our next question, which is really similar to this one, but kind of a different angle, is how much power do my suppliers have? The other businesses that you rely on in order to make your business go. And depending on the business type that you have, like for me as an appraiser, I don't really have any suppliers, right? I have software that I rely on, but there's other companies out there. So if that software went away, I could switch. It would be a pain, but I could do it. But Paul, you being in the egg business, you've been going through a little bit of an interesting and unique situation. Tell us a little bit about that and how you're having to navigate dealing with having only one supplier and them not being able to give you what you need.
Sure. So I am in the egg production and distribution business. And most recently, there's been this uprage about bird flu and this uprage about having to be compliant with cage-free birds, especially in the 14 states that most recently adopted that to their rules and regulations in egg production. And so we were reliant primarily on my production of birds for a minute. They provided a good number of eggs, and we supplied them to our restaurants and individuals. Well, all of a sudden, this whole movement with lack of eggs out there in the stores and in distribution created it so that I could actually provide and supply. Well, I was reliant on one major outside supplier outside of my own hen's laying. And then that supplier got bottlenecked up and didn't have eggs for us to distribute. So that caused a little backlog and bottleneck for myself in my clients being able to be provided with eggs for a duration of time. So now I've been able to find another resource to provide us our additional eggs that we need. But once again, never rely on just one resource in situations like this where there is a national problem with getting that one resource. It could put your business at a dead stop, or even worse, it could crush your business because of the dead stop. So there are ramifications of relying on one source. So not being able to source your inventory, your cost of good, could cause you a detrimental sacrifice, as we'll call it, in your ability to provide to your customer and to your client base. Always try to make sure that you have a backup plan, plan A and plan B, whether it's your inventory or whether it's having cash on the side, so that rainy day money. Always have a second source or a third or a fourth so that you don't get caught with this, oh my goodness, what are we going to do situation.
I think Tesla is an interesting example of this kind of strategy. Yes. Because they get batteries from Panasonic, they manufacture their own batteries, and then I believe in China they have another manufacturer of batteries for the kind of that whole part of the world that they serve. But they also were able to navigate the chip shortage that happened over the pandemic better. Yes. Than most automakers, because they make their own chips, and they have, because so much of what they do is in-house, they were able to pivot and change the way they made their chips in order to keep up supply with all the demand. Because remember, like if you remember during the pandemic, we had not only some supply constraints due to factory shutdowns and things like that, but we also in America had demand surges in various sectors because of either people working from home and then saving money and then being able to spend that money, or due to government stimulus packages going out and all of a sudden people think, oh, I have all this discretionary income. So you had lower supply, higher demand, and a lot of automakers were really struggling to keep up because they couldn't get these microchips. And because, you know, most automakers are not really automakers. They're more like auto assemblers. They put the cars together, but other companies are making most of the parts.
True.
Except for maybe like body panels, which are custom, but like all the computer modules and stuff, those are provided by third party manufacturers. And Tesla was different. They had more stuff in-house and they were able to pivot. So, you know, as a business, you do have to rely on other companies and other suppliers, but the more you can insulate yourself from risk and turbulence, the better off you'll be able to weather those storms when they inevitably come, because they will. And if you can develop the reputation as a business of being the reliable, steady supply for either your customers or the businesses that you serve, like Paul does, you can actually take these storms as an opportunity to grow where others are shrinking or struggling to survive.
Absolutely. Never get caught with your pants down, as they would say.
We try our best, right? We try our best.
Absolutely.
Moving on to the next question, we want to ask or encourage you to ask yourself, do I have the right customers? And this kind of ties in a little bit to what we alluded to earlier, which is, are you targeted in the market of the customers and the clientele that you are trying to serve? We talked about this book and the graphics design company switching from being sort of a do-it-all to focusing just on logos. And the result of that was a massive growth in the business. So in another, this is another way of saying, do you understand what you're really good at and the type of customers that you serve really well? And not only that you serve well, but the customers that are thrilled to have you serve them. We had Sarah Ackerman on a few weeks ago, and she talked about one of her recommendations to a photography client was to ask himself, who are the customers that I enjoy working with the most? Who are the ones that pay well, that aren't a headache, that get great results from me and love what I do? And they were able to narrow down from just general photography to high-performing, career-oriented women who are still single but are having a kid through various means. And so it's pregnancy-based photography, maternity photography, but for career-oriented, high-performing women. I mean, talk about a niche of a niche.
Very specific.
But that changes the messaging, it changes the advertising, it changes the website, the way that you present yourself as a service, and because of being specialized, allowed this individual to raise their prices.
Absolutely. So finding your special customer, your special client, is integral in your business. One of the things I always look at for my clientele is, what do I want to get from them? Not just what they're getting from me, right? What do I want to get from them? In the accounting world, I really want to just narrow and hone in on small businesses. I don't want to work with people who have 100 plus employees. I can't take on that type of clientele and do them a justice in the service, right? So when you're providing for that special clientele or that avatar of a client that you want to literally handhold or not handhold, you're making your sacrifice to them. But what sacrifice are they making for you? That's something that we don't ever think about. And that's kind of catching my thought right now, is what do we each need to sacrifice? And knowing your clientele and knowing who your target market is, as we just spoke earlier, all go hand in hand to this avatar of a client. So make that checklist of what you want that client to be like so that you know who you're going to market to. How many of those people do you want in your door that are that type of clientele, or do you want all of them to be just like that? That is the question, right? Do I want all my clients to be the same? I don't know about you, but I like a little diversity in my life, so I don't want them all to be the same, but I would like for them to have the same kind of mindset so that when we're working together, because it is a symbiotic relationship, we're able to create a buy-sell. And that's all we're doing, a buy-sell, and making sure that transaction is smooth. We're making sure that you get what you want and you like the service that I provided. So there goes the hand-in-hand in one respect. Another respect is, do I want this client and do I want the future clients to be the types that are going to refer clients to me? I didn't talk about that previously in some other aspects of our show, but now I just think about it. Do we want that kind of referral base from who our current client or customer is? And the word and the answer is absolutely yes. We want that symbiotic relationship where we're sharing and they are sharing back with us.
Our final question for this week is, what is working? I mean, if your business is in business, if you're making any money, there's something in your business that's probably working and maybe working pretty well. And sometimes as entrepreneurs, we're so inclined to have the shiny object syndrome. Like we always want to do the new thing. And sometimes what we need to do is just more of what we're already doing that's working. If there's something in your business that is, you know, maybe you offer six different services, but man, this one service has high margins, has a high customer satisfaction, maybe you should just do more of that.
Absolutely. Never spread yourself too thin, especially if you don't have the bandwidth or the support, whether they be employees or outside support, it's good to hone in on what you know best or what you have available to sell. Never sell something more or sell something you don't have and you have to go look for it. I've seen so many people who have literally opened up their doors to all these clients and realized that they don't have the team to support that type of work, A. And what's even worse is that they promise something that they're not skilled in, whether it was a product or whether it was a service. That is the worst thing you can do to shoot yourself in the foot by offering the world to somebody just because you want that client. That's not what you want to do. Sell your best abilities and your best products you have available.
Many times, a lot of what businesses lack is really just focus.
Absolutely.
You know, it's focusing on, like we've been saying kind of throughout this whole episode, it's kind of a common theme of like what you do well, what your employees or your staff can do well, and what you can make a high margin or profit on. For example, my older brother, who's a contractor, he's sort of retooling his business from being kind of a do-it-all general contractor to specializing in tile work. Because it's tile is something that he does really well. You can charge a lot of labor for because it's a specialty skill. And he's able to make a lot of profit doing tile work. And there's hardly anyone out there who does it better than he does, like in any given market. So that kind of focus allows, you know, now all of a sudden we've been talking about how that focus changes how his website should look, the kind of photos that he needs for marketing materials, how he's going to market himself on Angie's List and other lead generating website sources. And that focus can be really helpful for you as a business, even because as you think about training employees, rather than training employees on, okay, here's how we install cabinets and here's how we do drywall and here's how we paint and here's how we do siding. We'd be like, okay, we're just going to do tile. And we're going to do tile all day, every day for weeks and months on end. It's going to be a lot easier to train your employees in doing that skill well, especially if you're hiring unskilled labor and trying to train them yourself, than I do these 10 different things and you have to learn how to do all of them.
Absolutely. We're not the superheroes of the world. We are only what we can do, and what we can do is only do what we can do best.
So we hope that these questions and these thoughts and ideas we've been throwing around are really helpful for you. Again, I encourage you to check out this book, Built to Sell by John Warlow. This is not sponsored by John or the publisher by any means, but it's a book that I read and found very helpful and interesting, and I think you will too. We would love to hear from you, our audience. Please like, subscribe, comment below. Let us know what you think, and we will see you in the next one.